I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. A tremendous book out this season is the biography of Canada's 11th Prime Minister, Richard Bedford Bennett. John Boyko, the book's author, has written one of the first major biographies of R.B. Bennett, who was in office during the worst years of the Great Depression. We learn more about Bennett's policies and politics and see how he's gone down in history, whether fairly or unfairly, in this highly readable, relevant book. I particularly enjoy the author's grasp of history, how he connects various events and people in Canadian political history to Bennett, either in contrast or comparison. This, I think, makes the book lively and highly contextualized. John Boyko is the Dean of History and Social Sciences and Director of the Northcote Campus at Lakefield College School in Lakefield, Ontario. He's written other books, Into the Hurricane, Attacking Socialism and the CCF, and Last Steps to Freedom, The Evolution of Canadian Racism. He joins me now from Lakefield. The book, Bennett, the Rebel Who Challenged and Changed a Nation, is published by Key Porter. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John Boyko. Good morning, Mr. Boyko.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. How did you come about to write about Bennett?
Well, you mentioned my last book, which was about the CCF, the old Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. It was in my research for that book that I ended up reading a good deal about the 1930s, where that party was born, which led me, obviously, to be encountering Bennett. And the more I read about Bennett, the more he fascinated me, because he seemed to be quite a remarkable man, and yet, at the time, and certainly historians afterward, had nothing but terrible things to say about the guy. And there seemed to be a disconnect between what he actually accomplished and his reputation. So that led me to read more about him, and then I discovered, as you noted, that nothing had really been written about him in terms of a full biography, and so I was off to the races.
Why was that, do you think, that there was no big biography of him after he left office or after he died, perhaps?
Well, there's a number of things, and I think most probably is because he left office. He was basically hounded from office in 1935 for a number of things that really weren't his fault, because he had been in office for the worst times of the Depression. Probably the worst single year was 33, and there it was right in the middle of his mandate, and great many people blamed him for the Depression, despite the fact that it had begun a year before he took office, and blamed him for somehow being unable to solve the thing, despite the fact that it was getting better by the time he left. The other thing is that he was compared to the President of the United States at the time, was Roosevelt, who was one of the most charismatic presidents the United States has ever had. And while Bennett had a lot of strengths, charisma was not one of them. And as a result of Mackenzie King following him in office and putting into, or at least keeping a lot number of things that Bennett had enacted, keeping them going and therefore getting credit for them, Bennett was not thought of well. And so when people see someone who doesn't have a very good reputation, often they're not attracted to write about the guy, and no one did for a good long while.
So when you research him, or when you found out more about him, was he as bad as people had thought of him as?
No, not nearly. And there's several things that were interesting. One, that the argument that he ran a one-man government. There was a joke at the time, even, that people were on tour of Parliament Hill, and suddenly there was a man in a suit went by mumbling to himself, and the tourist asked the guide, "What's with that guy?" And the tour guide said, "Don't worry, that's just Prime Minister Bennett holding a cabinet meeting." And the notion was that he was running this one-man government, keeping all power to himself. And yet, when I read a number of things that were written by people with whom he worked, it wasn't true at all. Both the senators that were in the Senate who wrote about him allowing bills to be introduced in the Senate because they had a better chance of passing that way, or cabinet ministers that said, "No, he gave me free rein to do what I want." So there was a number of times in which it was really not true, despite the fact that he had that reputation.
And when maybe it's because we don't know much about the 30s in Canadian politics, but it doesn't seem that we know, say, the number two man in his cabinet or anything like that. So say, as we know, Ernest Lapointe with Mackenzie King, or I'm trying to think, C.D. Howe,
yeah,
or something like that. You know, or someone like that. Are there people that emerge that were close to Bennett that come out?
Yeah, there were a few. Part of the reason why we don't know about the number two man, who is usually somebody, not Howe, but usually somebody from Quebec, is many Canadian prime ministers who are English get a Quebec lieutenant. So there's the French. And there was, in the 1920s and 30s, a real split in Quebec, where the Quebec Conservative Party was really splintering into three, and he made the decision that in order to heal that, what we needed to do was to ensure that there was no Quebec lieutenant, because that's usually what they were fighting for, is the ability to be that Quebec lieutenant. And so we didn't do that. So, and as a result of that, there really wasn't that number two man, the Quebec lieutenant, the deputy prime minister, that type of person. But there were a number of other cabinet ministers that did rise, and as a matter of fact, others that became the head of the Conservative Party after he left. So what we had was Bennett, who was, however, I know this partially argues about what I was just saying, but he was having not only the prime ministership, but he held three other cabinet posts as well. Now, a lot of other prime ministers have done that, but nobody had ever appointed themselves also the finance minister. And for the first 3 years of his reign, he was also the finance minister, which meant that almost every question that got asked in question period, because it was the Depression, that was the number one issue, he was answering almost every question, which meant that he really was overpowering other people in the cabinet. But they each had their role to play.
I understand there's another book on Bennett coming out shortly.
Next year sometime, yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of this sort of revival towards Bennett? I guess, is it our economic times, perhaps, that we could learn more from them?
You know, it's interesting. I was asked that question a little while ago, and the answer is really no. I can't speak for the other author. I don't know. But for myself, I began working on this book about 4 years ago, which means it was almost done by the time the economic collapse happened in 2008. But as soon as the economic collapse did happen in October 2008, and we suffered the worst of it in 2009, all of a sudden there was a great interest in the Depression, because what we had were pundits falling over themselves trying to think up new ways of comparing the Great Recession that we're in now to the Great Depression of the 1930s. So obviously there was more of an interest in Bennett, who led us through those years. So it's interesting. I think something else that has happened just in the last while is there's a growing recognition that our current Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is very much like Bennett in a few ways. I won't go on and on about this, but I believe this is part of the new interest in Bennett. Harper and Bennett, for example, the only two Prime Ministers from Calgary, they're both known for their intelligence and their consistent ideological principles, and Stephen Harper, of course, has been accused, like I was just talking about Bennett, of drawing power to himself and liking the notion of the one man government. Both of them have the similar personalities in that they're seen as warm and charming in private, and yet they have these cold, aloof public demeanors. And what is fascinating, I think, is despite the fact that all of the fascinating things that Bennett did to promote the idea of a really activist government that needs to be powerful in order to do what needs to be done to get out of the economic morass, in the last little while we have seen Mr. Harper taking on more of those Bennett-like policies. The most blatant example, I think, is the new Canada Securities Act, which says that instead of 13 regulators, we're going to have one. Well, that's something that Bennett did, is installed more regulations on the banks and on the financial institutions in order to get out of the terrible economic time. So I think it's really fascinating that Harper is now, in substance, not only in style, very much like Bennett. So maybe that has something to do with the revival of interest in Bennett.
And the comparison with Harper, they both came to Calgary from elsewhere. They were born elsewhere. Now, Bennett was born in New Brunswick, right?
He was.
Yeah. Why did he go to Alberta?
He went as a very young man. He was a child prodigy in many ways, very intelligent. He was a school principal when he was only 19, but then left and entered law school in Dalhousie. and he was handpicked by a gentleman by the name of Sir James Lougheed, Peter Lougheed's grandfather, as a matter of fact, the Alberta Premier, who came to Halifax because he had heard that there was this whiz kid, and he picked him out of the Dalhousie Law School and made him a full partner in his firm out in Calgary. And so that's when Bennett went to Calgary as a very young man and became a full partner. Now, Lougheed had his, he was a senator, so he spent a good deal of time in Ottawa, which meant that Bennett really did run that firm. And the firm was small, but it did have a corporate client on, upon which it could build itself, and that the CPR, the Canadian Pacific Railway, was a great client to begin with. And from that, Bennett not only developed the firm, but he developed a talent for business. He ended up the president of a number of companies. He was the, on the board of directors of national and multinational corporations, and made a good deal of money in the stock market and land speculation, so that by the time he was 30, he was a multimillionaire.
How old was he when he met Beaverbrook?
He met Lord Beaverbrook before he was Lord Beaverbrook. Beaverbrook was about 9 years old, and Bennett was about 17, and they met on the a train station platform, and they Beaverbrook walked up to him. He was Max Aiken at that point, and started chatting him up, and they, despite the difference in their ages, they became good friends, and they remained good friends throughout their lives. And in fact, many of the business dealings that I was just talking about, it was Beaverbrook and Bennett together.
And they were drawn to each other because they were also very different, weren't they?
They were very different. Where Harper, no, not Harper, sorry, there's that slip, where Bennett was quite reserved and was actually quite shy. As Trudeau and many other prime ministers, when you really got under the surface of their public persona, was quite a shy man, where Beaverbrook was anything but shy. And they were a very good team, because where Bennett would be the detail guy who would be able to put the intricate deals together and then actually run companies on a day-to-day basis, it was Beaverbrook that would be able to take the idea of a company and go sell those stocks, sell the bonds, and in the foreign markets, and really bring the money and the people together to make the companies work. And the amalgamations that he and Bennett put together would make them work. So they were a tremendous team.
Is it because of Beaverbrook that Bennett ended up in England?
Yeah, Bennett had a fascination with England from when he was a child. He was a voracious reader. He used to read everything that he could get his hands on, and his favorite was political biographies, and he was, even as a child, fascinated with political biographies dealing with just the statesmen that were in England at the time, mostly conservative statesmen. And so he visited England every chance he got, and usually it was once or sometimes twice a year, even when he was prime minister. And so when he left office in 1935, it was almost natural that he would be visiting Beaverbrook again in England, and Beaverbrook made the offer, why don't you just come here? Bennett made the decision that, and this is interesting given what some of other prime ministers have done, when he left office in 1935, he continued as opposition leader for a little while, but then he made the decision that it would be wrong to continue in business and play on the fact that he used to be prime minister. He thought that would not be good for the office of prime minister. He didn't think that would be fair. Second thing is, he wanted to continue in public service, and he knew that his days in public service were over in Canada, and so he moved to England and got a house, large mansion of a house next to Beaverbrook's estate, and it was there that he became involved in the war effort. The Second World War was beginning, and played a major role in especially the aeronautics industry in during the war, so much so that Churchill appointed him to the House of Lords.
Now, people, because of his exile, in this country at least, They viewed that as wrong, right? They didn't like that part of him, that he had to leave, and they viewed him as sort of that he cut and run, I guess.
Yeah, which is unfortunate, because the election was 1935. He was an opposition leader for 2 years and didn't leave, and for 2 years after that. So it's not like he lost the election and left the next day. And the reasons that Moyle were discussed were the reasons that, he left. And while he was there, he did so much good. I mentioned the aeronautics industry. He was involved through the House of Lords, for example, in setting up the civilian aeronautic industry in England, to the point where he was offered the directorship of the BOAC when it was formed. So he was still doing great good, and he realized that he would not be able to be doing that type of public service in Canada in the political sphere, where in the House of Lords, he didn't know he'd be in the House of Lords, but in the House of Lords he was able to do all of that good. So we had a guy who was passionate and active about being a citizen of action, and so therefore I think that's to be celebrated. The other thing, I guess, in answer to your question is, when he left, he did something of a victory tour, and he visited a good number of cities right across Canada, and at every stop he was cheered. There were speeches that he made at a number of places throughout Canada, and every place it was sold out. There was standing room only at places where he spoke, and cheering crowds when he appeared. That was only 2 years after he had lost the election, so it's not like the Canadians had not forgiven him. They have, so he wasn't running from that, and it's not like everyone in Canada, despite the stereotypes that some would have you believe, had dismissed the guy. So I don't know, that's one of the stereotypes that is unfortunate, but it's one of the stereotypes that I discovered that simply wasn't true.
Now we're jumping here because there's just so much to talk about. Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't discussed yet some of his great achievements in his term. I mean, you go down the list here: the Bank of Canada, the National Wheat Board, the CBC.
Yeah.
We can trace those all back to Bennett, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Were these the reforms that he wanted to put in because of the Depression? How much of those were overturned by courts?
Well, none of those that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
The CBC, for example, the radio in the late 20s and early 30s, he came into office in October 1930. So at that time, radio was as if the internet of the last 10 years, say. It was the brand new technology that was being fought by the old technologies, newspapers and the like. And he looked at that as something that needed to be given government support, just as the internet was something that the government needed to deal with when it was created. And he also looked at what a number of countries were doing with radio and said that a publicly owned radio network was good for the country for a number of reasons, one of which was to enhance Canada's nationhood, because he saw the influx of American culture pouring over the border. And he thought this is one way in which Canadians could speak with other Canadians, with Canadian stories. And that's something that the CBC still does to this day. And so therefore, against great many people who railed against his plans for that, he decided that it was worth the political cost. And many people left the conservative camp, because you could imagine many of the corporate elite were against that on its face, and he knew he would lose their support, and he did it anyway because he thought it was good for the country. The same thing came for the Bank of Canada. Now, the Bank of Canada came as a result of the fact that since Confederation, but certainly at that time in the middle of the Depression, monetary policy was controlled by the chartered banks. The chartered banks controlled interest rates and a good deal to do with foreign trade, and to the point where they literally printed money. And almost every other modern industrial country in the world had a central bank. We didn't. And he realized that that needed to happen. You could imagine the number of people and powerful interests in Canada that did not want that power to shift from the chartered banks to this newly created chartered bank or central bank, and yet he fought all of those people who were railing against him about that, and many people within his own party, within his own caucus, and even in cabinet. So I think he's to be admired for his political courage for those things. Other things that you didn't mention, is that he began negotiations that led directly to the building of the St. Lawrence Seaway and other things. So he was a man of incredible vision, but also a man who could summon the political courage to get things done.
Now, his unmaking or undoing with the Conservative Party, he left that at some point and created his own party too, right?
Not Bennett. There was another guy that did that.
That's Stevens, right?
Stevens, yeah. Mm-hmm. Harry Stevens left for a good number of reasons, and they had arguments that were both philosophical and personal, despite the fact that they'd been friends for over a decade and a half. Stevens was far to the left, almost to the populist left of Bennett and much of the Conservative Party, and he did a number of things that many would interpret as simply wrong, that no prime minister would be able to put up with. And so as a result of that, there was a spat between the two of them that could have been easily resolved, but it wasn't. And so Stevens left and formed his own party, the Reconstruction Party, which ran a candidate in every one of the ridings and only in 1935, and only won one seat, Stevens' own seat out in B.C. And the Reconstruction Party didn't last long after that, but that was one of the factors that led to the loss in 1935 for the Conservatives.
And in his term in office, he was seen as sort of a hard ass when we think of like the Ottawa trek and how government and the police, I guess, at the time, reacted to protesters. This meeting with A.E. Smith,
mm-hmm.
and I guess Smith was critical of Bennett, right?
Yeah, Smith was a communist. The Communist Party was born in 1922, and it was very powerful in a good number of unions in Canada at the time. And at the time, it was literally an arm of the Russian Comintern. Stalin had indirect, but he had control over the Communist parties in a number of countries. And the Communist Party of Canada took direction from Russia. And so while we look at communism a little bit differently now, in 1920s and 1930s when he was in power, the Russian Revolution was relatively recent. The Communist Party was very powerful and getting more powerful by the day. So that was one of the things that Bennett was looking at when he saw the work camps that were in northern B.C. and a number of other provinces, but especially in northern B.C., being infiltrated by the Communist Party and a number of communist agitators having people leave those camps and go down to Vancouver where the Vancouver strike. Now, I am not by any means saying if there were no Communist Party around, everybody would have been happy with the work camps. Of course not. There was lots of problems with the work camps, and all the people who were involved with the strike and then eventually with the Ottawa trek were not communists at all. That's not what I'm saying. But what Bennett did, and in this case his political antenna were off, he believed that the Communist Party and the communist agitators were directly responsible for all of the actions that were being taken, and so therefore it needed to be fought against. So in that way, his antenna was off. When he asked the RCMP to stop them in Regina, they did. He didn't order the RCMP to do what they actually did, that is, wade into the crowd and essentially start a riot where a number of people were hurt and an officer was killed. But often when the political leaders order something to be done, the RCMP takes over, and often what ends up happening is not what the political leader had in mind at all, but it certainly happened. He got the reputation of being called Iron Heel Bennett, and part of the reason he lost the 1935 election was because of his actions with respect to the Vancouver strike and the Ottawa protest.
He never married. Were there women in his life?
There were many women in his life, but no, he never did marry, and he went out with a good number of women, proposed to two, who both said no to him. Part of the reason that he turned his great wealth into even greater wealth is that one of his longtime friends was a woman by the name of Jenny Eddy, who married E.B. Eddy of the Eddy Match Company, still a powerful corporation in Ottawa and in throughout the world, as a matter of fact, with paper products and wood. And what he did when she died is inherited almost all of the shares, and he became even richer. So, yeah, he was by no means a prig in that territory. In fact, there was at one point where there was nearly a sex scandal because He spent most of the summer in Quebec in the eastern townships with a woman who in those scandalous days had been divorced, and oh my goodness, but the press was a little bit different then than now. I don't know whether he would get away with it now, but at the time, even when the news leaked out, there was a tut-tutting going on.
John, this is such a great book.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with the book. I've enjoyed the chat today.
Fabulous. I really appreciate the call, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks very much. The book is called Bennett, The Rebel Who Changed, who Challenged and Changed a Nation. It's published by Key Porter. Do get it. If you think that the 30s and politics is dull, and it's not, there's so much contemporary connections to today that just make for fascinating reading. It's author John Boyko on the line from Lakefield, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.